Let's go ahead and open our scripture to the last chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. Remember that the book of Deuteronomy means second law. It represents the final address of the great prophet Moses to the people of Israel on the plains of Moab in the 11th month of the 40th year of the Exodus. It's his way as the teacher of the past four decades to this group of cramming the last bit of review material into their hearts and minds before he releases them into the hands of Joshua to take them into the promised land. He is about to go up onto the mount that is east of the Israeli encampment in Moab and pass away. And all of this because he did not show proper glory and honor for God in an incident at the beginning of the 40th year. Chapter 34, verse 1. Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo. Now, I happen to believe that Nebo gets its name from a slight variation in the Hebrew word prophet, Nabi. And so I think Nebo is actually Mount Prophet, named that because of this is where Moses is going to go. So he goes up to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah. Pisgah has something to do with a cliff or a cleft, such as the rugged territory that this hillside has, which is opposite Jericho. So Jericho is the big city of the Canaanites that is on the western side of the Jordan River that they've been looking at for the last few months. And so that's being used to relate to the direction of where Nebo is located. He who is showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the Negev and the plain, that is the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees as far as Zoar. Now, I happen to believe that this is a supernatural vision that God gives to Moses. If you are standing, as he was, up on the top of this highland to the east of the Jordan Valley and east of the top of the Dead Sea, you would be able to see quite some ways up and down that valley and take in an awful lot of the promised land just by your natural sight. On a clear day, he probably could have seen down past the end of the Dead Sea to his left. And he probably could have seen all the way up to where the Sea of Galilee was to the north, if it had been a marvelously clear day. But the description that we receive here is that he has even shown things that are up and over the ridgeline of the center part of the Promised Land, because it talks here about seeing Judah as far as the Western Sea. That's the Mediterranean. You could not naturally see the Mediterranean from this spot on Mount Pisgah. So I am convinced that God is giving him this supernatural panoramic view of the Promised Land to make up for the fact that he has to die here on the eastern side of Jordan, outside of the Promised Land, because of what he chose to do earlier. So God is being gracious to him. Some of the other things that we should take note of here is the city of palm trees. That is another name for Jericho, because there would have been huge palm tree plantations there. And Zoar, that's the south end of the Dead Sea. It was the only city of the cities of the plain that was spared in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse number 4. He who is said to him, "This is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Yitzhak, to Jacob. So this is what I promised to them. I will give it to your offspring. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there. So again, God being gracious to the prophet Moses for his years of service, even though he messed up big time in the beginning of this 40th year. So Moses, the servant of He Who Is, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of He Who Is, and he, meaning God himself, buried him in the valley in the land of Moab opposite Beth Peor. But no one knows the place of his burial to this day. And I believe in the literalness of that statement. There is a place, I think, that is traditionally marked over here on Mount Nebo as the tomb of Moses, but they're just guessing that it's somewhere in that vicinity. Verse 7, Moses was 120 years old when he died. So he spent 40 years in Egypt growing up as the adopted son of the princess of Egypt, but being raised also by his natural mom. She was his nursemaid or his wet nurse that helped him keep his connection with the Israeli side of his story. Then you know that when he came around his 40th year, that he made that attempt to free the Israelis because he thought that's what was wanted, and it backfired, and he ends up killing a taskmaster and having to run for his life. So he spent the next 40 years in the area of Midian, east of the Gulf of Aqaba, outside the territory of Egypt, and relative obscurity as far as the Egyptians were concerned, but fairly well-placed in the society there because his father-in-law was the priest of Midian, the spiritual leader of that country. And then, of course, he spent the final 40 years of his life on this wilderness quest, dealing with the rebellious generation that had been penalized and could not go into the promised land, and helping raise up this new generation that he's now finished giving the second law to. So that's how you divide the 120 years of Moses up into three equal parts of 40. The report is given here. And by the way, I think this last chapter was written by someone later and then appended to the book of Moses. Probably not Joshua, since the city of Dan is mentioned here. It's probably a later prophet, a couple of generations later, after Dan had come into existence. But this is what is reported. His eye was undimmed and his vigor unabated. So at 120 years of age, he hadn't lost any of his steps. He could see perfectly, and he had all of the strength that he had from his younger years. Very amazing. So that means that effectively God just switched him off when it came time for him to die, and then buried him in an unmarked grave on on the mountains of Moab, Mount Pisgah, in what is now today the territory of Jordan. Verse 8, and the people of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days, and then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended. So more than likely, the things that we'd looked at in the book of Deuteronomy up through chapter 33 filled out the month, the 11th month of the 40th year. And then Moses apparently died toward the end of that 11th month, maybe the very beginning of the 12th month. And it was declared, because of who he was, that they would grieve his loss for a full 30 days. I actually think they probably spent the entire 12th month saying their goodbyes. And then they were done and ready to go into the Promised Land, because a new year, the 41st year, would have been dawning. Verse number 9, let's get ready for that. And Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. That had happened in a ceremony earlier in the 40th year, so that there was a clear transfer of authority and supernatural power from the prophet to the new prophet, Joshua. So the people of Israel obeyed him and did as he who is had commanded Moses. And there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom he who is knew face to face. And so that's another reason to believe that this is the authoring of a future prophet in the land of Israel that's putting this as an addition, a final appendix to the writings of Moses the prophet. None like him for all the signs and wonders that he who is sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, and for all the mighty power and all the great deeds of terror that Moses did in all the sight of Israel. And thus ends the fifth book of Moses, and therefore the five books of Moses, the first section of both the Israeli writings, prophetic writings, and the Christian division or understanding of the Old Testament. We now turn our attention to the next book historically, and that is the book of Joshua. And right off the bat, I'm going to do something that I hope won't confuse you, but I think in the long run will help you understand the chronology of what happens next. A lot of times when we tell stories, we will tell a story up to a point, and then we will have to go back and fill in details. That's a very common way that we tell the story. In this case, I want to jump to chapter 2 of the book of Joshua and tell the pre-story of what will lead up to chapter number 1. Because basically, chapter number 2 kind of catches us up on what follows at the time for the crossing of the Jordan River. So, chapter number 2 of Joshua says, "And Joshua the son of Nun sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies." Now, Shittim is the name of the encampment where Israel was during the entire book of Deuteronomy. And it means the place of the acacia trees. So once the mourning time for Moses is coming to an end, and the new year has begun, Joshua knows that they will soon be crossing the Jordan River, and he wants more details about the city of Jericho that is going to be the first city of the Canaanites that they have to deal with. So he sends these spies into the land, and I believe that if we do the chronology correctly, he sends them in on the sixth day of the first month of the 41st year. And so on our calendar, that would effectively be right around the middle of April of 1416 BC. And he says, "Go, view the land, especially Jericho." So go on in there, check it out, but really pay attention to what's going on in the city of Jericho. So they went and they came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and lodged there. So this is the first time that we meet the ancestress of King David and therefore of Jesus himself, Rahab the Canaanite woman. And she is said here to be a prostitute. Now, I have a little bit of hesitation to say that she is selling her body for money, because the same word can simply mean a woman of loose morals, not somebody that's actually involved in the sex trade. So let's leave it open to the fact that she was not living a life that she should have been living. There's zero doubt about that. But she was a woman of prominence. She actually owned a house, an inn, on the wall of the city. It was actually part of the wall. And the spies end up staying at her house. Makes good sense, because they want to be somewhere where they can get all the latest gossip. And so an inn where people stay as they're traveling through town would be the perfect place for that. They're going to be able to learn not just about Jericho, but all the places that Jericho services. Verse number 2. It was told to the king of Jericho, "Behold, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." Now, maybe this is also the time we should talk about the sizes of these cities. More than likely, Jericho is not more than a few thousands of people in size, 10,000, maybe 15, 20,000. So the king of Jericho here is the city-state governor. He runs this town. And he finds out, because it's being noised about, people are asking questions, that these two Israelis are in town, and that does not bode well for him. Because for the last several months, they've been seeing that encampment across the river. Now, Jericho is about 6 miles from Jordan, and then more than likely the Israeli encampment about 4 or 5 miles beyond that. So let's just call it about 10 miles away. The people of Jericho can see, especially at night, the glow of that tower of fire and the canopy above of God's presence that is over the encampment of Israel. And they've no doubt had people go over there and see it for themselves. There are traders that go up and down the trade route that goes across the fords of Jericho or the fords of the Jordan here. And they've been able to see it and report this stuff. So the king of Jericho is nervous already that the Israelis are across there. And he is not happy that there's two of them in his town. So he starts looking for them. Verse 3, the king of Jericho sent to Rahab saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land." But the woman who had taken the two men and hidden them, she said, "True, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And when the gate was about to be closed at dark, the men went out, and I don't know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." So she covers for them. And yes, she did lie. And you can deal with that however you want to, on the fact that God used her to protect these men and that she used a lie to do it. God would have protected them without the lie, I guarantee you. So she hides them and tells her own king, "They're not here. Yeah, they came in. I didn't know who they were. And now they've left. Maybe you should chase them down." But she's spent enough time with them that she has already in her heart determined that the God of these guys is the God she'd rather be aligned with. So the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. She'd brought them, this is verse 6, up to the roof and hid them with the stalks of flax that she had laid in order on the roof. It was the season of the cutting of the flax plants, which get used in making of linen. And of course, you dry them up on the flat areas above your house. And in her house, it was right up against the wall. So she's got flax laying out probably on drying platforms everywhere. And that's where she hid them, was underneath those drying flax areas. So the men pursued after them on the way to the Jordan as far as the fords. The gate was shut as soon as the pursuers had gone out. So it's after dark. The gates have already been locked. Rahab says, no, they're not here. They left before the gates were closed. And the pursuers go chasing after them down the trade road that goes down to the crossing point on the Jordan about 6 miles away. And they're not going to find them because they're not there. They're hiding up on the top of the house. And the gates are relocked after the pursuers go. Verse number 8. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof, and she said to the men, I know that Yahweh, because this is the name that is being noised about now, this God that the Israelis serve. I know that he who is has given you the land. So she is convinced the Israelis have already won. Their God is giving this property to them. And that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. So she hears people talk as they come through her inn all the time. And she knows everyone is panicked. Apparently, some of them are leaving the cities. This melting away, that is what happens in urban areas when war is being threatened. People leave because they don't want to get caught up in the fight. So whatever the population of Jericho was before the Israelis set up camp on the other side of the Jordan, it is much smaller now because they've melted away. And verse number 10, for we have heard how he who is dried up the waters of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt. So that was 40 years ago, and that's still being talked about. And what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. That's only been about a year or less ago that those things happened. Actually, less than a year ago. And those two kings were scary to everybody on that side of the Jordan. They'd taken over, Sihon had taken over property from the Moabites. So everybody was afraid of those guys, and yet the Israelis just rolled over them in a matter of weeks. So she brings that up. Verse 10, as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted. There's no spirit left in any man because of you. For he who is your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. So that is her confession of faith. This is part of her conversion process. Now then, please swear to me by he who is, that as I have dealt kindly with you, you will also deal kindly with my father's house, and give me a sure sign that you will save alive for my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death. And the men said to her, our life for years, even to death, if you do not tell this business of ours, then when he who is gives us the land, we will deal kindly and faithfully with you. So because she has expressed a desire to convert to the true faith of the one and true God, they agree with her that she and her family will be spared in the coming occupation of the land of promise. Have a great weekend. We'll pick up this story next week at that exact spot.